The Cancer Journals was written over a 6-month period following a mastectomy that I had for breast cancer, and I wrote it because I could not find in my immediate surroundings any material that had been done by women, by black women, by feminists, and because my acute awareness that cancer, that breast cancer, is a factor in so many of our lives, and it is one of those subjects, like death, that suffers under complete silence, because so often we think, or we are led to believe, that if we ignore a problem or if we pretend it doesn't exist, then somehow it loses its power over us. But of course the opposite is true, that those things that we are silent about gain power. And of course in 1978, when I had mastectomy, the percentage of women with breast cancer in America was 1 in 13. Now that statistic has gone down to 1 in 11. So the whole area, the consideration of breast cancer, is something that I think every woman needs to acquaint herself with and needs to give some concern to, even on the level of consistent self-examination, monthly self-examinations, and so forth. I'm going to read a few pieces from the introduction and share with you some information also that I think we all need to at least be cognizant of. Each woman responds to the crisis that breast cancer brings to her life out of a whole pattern, which is the design of who she is and how her life has been lived. The weave of my everyday existence is the training ground for how I handle crisis. I'm a post-mastectomy woman who believes our feelings need voice in order to be recognized, respected, of use. I do not wish my anger and pain and fear about cancer to fossilize into yet another silence, nor to rob me of whatever strength can lie at the core of this experience, openly acknowledged and examined. For other women of all ages, colors, and sexual identities, who recognize that imposed silence about any area of our lives is a tool for separation and powerlessness, and of course for myself, I have tried to voice some of my feelings and thoughts here about the travesty of prosthesis, the pain of amputation, the function of cancer in a profit economy, my confrontations personally with mortality, the strength of women loving, and the power and rewards of self-conscious living. Breast cancer and mastectomy are not unique experiences. They're ones that are shared by thousands of American women. Each of these women has a particular voice to be raised in what must become a female outcry against all preventable cancers, as well as against the secret fears that allow these cancers to flourish. May these words serve as encouragement for other women to speak and to act out of our experiences with cancer and other threats of death. For silence has never brought us anything of worth. Most of all, may these words underline the possibilities of self-healing and the richness of living for all women. There is a commonality, you know, of isolation and painful reassessment that is shared by all women with breast cancer, whether this commonality is recognized by us or not. Now, it is not my intention here to judge the woman who chooses the path of prosthesis, which I think is a path of silence and invisibility, the woman who wishes to be the same as before. She has survived on another kind of courage, and she is not alone. Each one of us struggles daily with the pressures of conformity, the loneliness of difference, from which these choices seem to offer escape. I only know that they do not work for me, nor for other women who, not without fear, have survived cancer by scrutinizing its meaning within our lives and by attempting to integrate this crisis into some useful strength for change. Now, the cancer journals are divided into 3 essays plus an introduction. The first is an introduction of the transformation of silence into language and action. The second is really a step-by-step account with some excerpts from my journals during that period of what it was like, the actual operation, some of my fears, some of my concerns. And the third part is an essay, the title of which is Powell versus Prosthesis, which deals with some of the travesties of the medical association in regards to women and breast cancer, some of the kinds of silences that are imposed upon us by prosthesis. Now, when I speak of prosthesis, I'm speaking of the little pad of lamb's wool that Reach for Recovery, American Cancer Society organization, woman will usually bring to you in the hospital, and of course the silicone gel forms that all women with breast cancer are encouraged to wear so that it appears as if we are two-breasted women. And these are some excerpts from Power versus Prosthesis. In the critical and valuable period following surgery, self-examination and self-evaluation are positive steps. But to imply to a woman that, yes, she can be the same as before surgery, with a skillful application of a little puff of lamb's wool or silicone gel, is to place an emphasis upon prosthesis, which encourages the woman not to deal with herself as physically and emotionally real. This emphasis upon the cosmetic after surgery reinforces the society's stereotype about women, that we are only what we look or appear, so this is the only aspect of our existence that we need to address. I am talking here about the need for every woman to live a considered life. The necessity for that consideration grows and deepens as one faces one's own mortality and death. For as each one of us, as we open ourselves more and more to the genuine conditions of our lives, women become less and less willing to tolerate those conditions unaltered, or to passively accept external and destructive controls over our lives and our identities. Prosthesis offers the empty comfort of nobody will know the difference. But it is that very difference that I wish to affirm, because I have lived it and survived it, and wish to share that strength with other women. If we are to translate the silence surrounding breast cancer into language and action against this travesty within our lives, then the first step is that women with mastectomies must become visible to each other. For silence and invisibility go hand in hand with powerlessness. And by accepting the mask of prosthesis, one-breasted women proclaim ourselves as insufficients, depending upon pretense. We reinforce our own isolation and invisibility from each other, as well as the false complacency of a society that would rather not face the results of its own insanities. In addition, we withhold that visibility and support from one another, which is such an aid to perspective and self-acceptance. Surrounded by other women day by day, all of whom appear to have two breasts, it is very difficult sometimes to remember that I am not alone. Yet once I face death as a life process, what is there possibly left for me to fear? Who can ever really have power over me again? Now, the last piece that I wanted to read here today from Power versus Prosthesis is a short passage which deals with some information that I think it is vital that when we consider breast cancer, when we consider ourselves as individuals in relationship to this, whether or not we are threatened, whether or not we are afraid of it, but simply as another piece of the arsenal for survival. There are a couple of pieces of information that I think we really need to put in the hopper and keep in mind. And this is what this section deals with. Now, any information about the prevention or treatment of breast cancer which could possibly threaten the vested interests of the American medical establishment is very difficult to acquire in this country. Only through continuing scrutiny of various non-mainstream sources of information, such as the alternative presses, women's health center publications, can a picture of new possibilities for prevention and treatment of breast cancer emerge. Much of this secrecy is engineered by the American Cancer Society, which has become the loudest voice of the cancer establishment. The American Cancer Society is the largest philanthropic institution in the United States and the world's largest non-religious charity. Peter Chocwa points out that the National Information Bureau, which is a charity watchdog organization, lists the American Cancer Society among those groups which do not meet its standards. During the past decade, the American Cancer Society has collected over $1 billion from the American public. In 1977, it had a $176 million fund balance, yet less than 15% of that budget was spent on assisting cancer patients. Any holistic approach to the problem of cancer is therefore viewed by American Cancer Society with great suspicion and alarm. It has consistently focused upon the treatment of cancer rather than the prevention of cancer, and then only upon those treatments that are sanctioned by the most conservative branches of Western medicine. And I think here we have to remember that this is not by accidental, or this is not coincidence. We live in the midst and at the mercy of a profit economy. It is an economy that is geared certainly not to human needs or human good, but of course to the making of profit, which is a basically anti-human procedure. And of course, there is no profit in the prevention of cancer. Let me remind you of this again. There is no profit in the prevention of cancer within this society. There is only profit in the treatment of cancer. Now, in 1976, 70% of the American Cancer Society's research budget went to individuals and institutions with whom the ACS board members were affiliated. Now, of those 194 board members, one was a labor representative and one was black, and women are not even mentioned. The American Cancer Society was originally established to champion new research into the causes and cure of cancer. But by its whitelisting of new therapies without testing, the American Cancer Society spends much of its remaining budget in the suppression of new and unconventional ideas and research. And this is in the face of the fact that studies from other countries have shown very interesting and possibly hopeful results from treatments largely ignored by ACS. European Medicine reports hopeful experiments with immunotherapy, diet, treatments with hormones and enzymes such as trypsin, and even now there is much more work going on in the area. Silencing and political repression by establishment medical journals keeps much of this vital information about breast cancer underground and away from the women whose lives it most affects. Yet even in the United States, there are clinics that are still waging alternative wars against cancer as well as against the medical establishment, of course, with varying degrees of success. What we do need to be aware of is that breast cancer is on the increase, and every woman must add to her arsenal of information by inquiring into these areas of underground medicine. Who are its leaders and proponents? What are their qualifications? And most important, what is their rate of success in the control of breast cancer? Most of all, why is all of this information not common knowledge to us who are most immediately affected by it? The mortality for breast cancer, treated by the conventional therapies in this country, has not decreased in over 40 years. In other words, the survival rate for conventional treatments of cancer has not improved in over 40 years. Now, the American Cancer Society and its governmental partner, the National Cancer Institute, have been notoriously indifferent, if not actively hostile, to the idea of the general environmental causes of cancer and the need for government regulation and prevention. Now, since the American medical establishment and the ACS are determined to suppress any cancer information which is not dependent upon Western medical bias or any information that might possibly challenge a profit motive within this country, whether this information is ultimately useful or not, we must pierce this silence ourselves and aggressively seek answers to questions about new therapies. We must also heed the unavoidable evidence which points toward the nutritional and environmental causes of cancer and the aspects of cancer prevention. Cancer is not just another degenerative, unavoidable disease of the aging process. It has distinct, identifiable causes, and these are mainly exposures to chemical and physical agents in our environment. In other words, the man-made causes of cancer. In the medical literature, there is mounting evidence that breast cancer is a chronic and systemic disease, that many of us carry it, for instance, and fight it constantly with our immune defenses. Post-mastectomy women must be vigilantly aware that, contrary to the lightning strikes theory, we are the most likely of all women to develop cancer somewhere else in our bodies. But every woman has a militant responsibility to involve herself actively with her own health. We owe ourselves the protection of all the information each one of us can acquire about the treatment of cancer and its causes, as well as about the recent findings concerning immunology, nutrition, environment, and stress. And each one of us owes herself this information before she may have a reason to use it. Okay. That last selection was from, as I said, the Cancer Journals, which was published by Spinsters, Inc. It can be ordered from them. The price is $4, and their address is R.D. Wan, Argyle, New York, 12809. That's Spinsters, Inc., which is a small feminist press. The next thing I'm going to read this morning is a poem which is actually a chorale for black women's voices. The title of it is Need, and I'd like to tell you a little bit about the way this poem came to be written. It is dedicated to two women in particular, to Patricia Cohen, who is a young black actress who was killed in Detroit a number of years ago, and to Bobby Jean Graham, who is one of 12 black women, who were murdered within the course of 3 months in Boston in 1979. And this poem was written for those women and for the hundreds of other mangled black women whose nightmare informs my words. I think the issues of violence against black women has been a very touchy one, particularly in black communities, because I think in many ways we have thought that to discuss this would be in some way to weaken the support. I think that this is not true. I think that as black people, we must attend to our own communities if we are to move forward as a unified people at all, and to sweep problems that are very real under the rug only allows them, as with any silence, to of course flourish and continue to work their destructive ways. This poem is in three parts. The first part, each of the two women to whom it is dedicated has a voice, and then the poet speaks also. In the second part, the three women speak together, and in the third part, the poet speaks alone. The poem is introduced by a nursery rhyme, which I think most of you will be familiar with. I think we probably take it for granted and very seldom listen to the words of it. But the rhyme goes, "Tattle tale tit, your tongue will be slit, and every little boy in town shall have a little bit." Need, a chorale for black women's voices. This poem is dedicated to Patricia Cone and Bobby Jean Graham and the hundreds of other mangled black women whose nightmares inform my words. Part 1. This woman is black, so her blood is shed into silence. This woman is black, so her death falls to earth like the drippings of birds to be washed away with silence and with rain. For a long time after the baby came, I didn't go out at all, and it got to be really lonely. Then Bubba started asking about his father. I wanted to connect with the blood again, thought maybe I'd meet someone, we could move on together, help make the dream real. An ad in the paper said, black actress needed to audition in a play by black playwright. I was anxious to get back to work, thought this would be a good place to start. So on the way home from school with Bubba, I answered the ad. He put a hammer through my head. If you are hit in the middle of your body by a 10-ton truck, your caved-in chest bears the mark of a tire, and your liver pops like a rubber ball. If you are knocked down by boulders from a poorly graded hill, your dying is stamped by the rock print upon your crushed body, by the impersonal weight of it all, while your life drips out through your liver, smashed by the mindless stone. When your boyfriend methodically beats you to death in the alley behind your apartment, and the neighbors pull down their window shades because they don't want to get involved, the police call it a crime of passion, not a crime of hatred. But I still died of a lacerated liver and a man's heel imprinted upon my chest. Dead black women haunt the black-mailed streets, paying the city's secret and familiar tithe of blood. Burn blood, beat blood, cut blood, 7-year-old child rape victim blood, blood of a sodomized grandmother, blood, blood on the hands of my brother, blood and his blood clotting in the teeth of strangers. As women, we were meant to bleed, but not this useless blood. My blood, each month a memorial to my unspoken sisters, falling like red drops to the asphalt. I am not satisfied to bleed as a quiet symbol for no one's redemption. Why is it our blood that keeps these cities fertile? I do not even know all their names. My sister's deaths are not noteworthy, not threatening enough to decorate the evening news, not important enough to be fossilized between the right-to-life pickets and the San Francisco riots for gay liberation. Blood, Blood of my sisters fallen in this bloody war, no names, no medals, no exchange of prisoners, no packages from home, no time off for good behavior, no victories, no victors. Only us kept afraid to walk out into moonlight, lest we lose our power. Only us kept afraid to speak out, lest our tongues be slit for the witches we are, our chests crushed by the foot of our brawny acquaintance, and our ruptured liver bleeding out life onto the stones. And how many other deaths do we live through daily, pretending we are alive? Part 2. What terror embossed my face upon your hatred? What ancient and unchallenged enemy took on my flesh within your eyes? Came armed against you with laughter and a hopeful art, my hair catching the sunlight, my small son eager to see his mama at work? Now my blood stiffens in the cracks of your fingers raised to wipe the half-smile from your lips. In this picture of you, the face of a white policeman bends over my bleeding son, decaying into my brother who stalked me with a singing hammer. And what do you need me for, brother? To move for you, feel for you, die for you? You have a grave need for me, but your eyes are thirsty with vengeance, dressed in the easiest blood. When you opened my head with your hammer, did the boogies stop in your brain? The beat go on, the terror run out of you like curdled fury, a half-smile upon your lips? And did your manhood lay in my skull like a netted fish, or did it slip out like blood, like impotent fury off the tips of your fingers as your sledgehammer clove my bone to let the light out? Did you touch it as it flew away? Borrowed hymns veil the misplaced hatred, saying, you need me, you need me, you need me, like a broken drum, calling me black goddess, black hope, black strength, black mother. You touch me, and I die in the alleys of Boston, with a stomach stomped through the small of my back, a hammered-in skull in Detroit. A ceremonial knife through my grandmother's used vagina, my burned body hacked to convenience in a vacant lot. I lie in midnight blood like a rebel city bombed into false submission, and our enemies still sit in power and judgment over us all. I need you. Was there no place left to plant your hammer, spend anger, rest horror, no place left to dig for manhood except in my woman's brain? Do you need me, submitting to terror at nightfall? To chop into bits and stuff warm into plastic bags near the neck of the Harlem River, and they found me there, swollen with your need? Do you need me to rape in my seventh year till blood breaks the corners of my child's mouth, and you explain I was being seductive? Do you need me to print upon our children the destruction our enemies imprint upon you, like a Mack truck or an avalanche destroying us both, carrying home their hatred. You are relearning my value in an enemy coin. Part 3. I am weary of need that tastes like destruction. I am weary of need that tastes like destruction. Whoever learns to love me from the mouth of my enemies walks the edge of my world like a phantom in a crimson cloak, and the dream books speak of money, but my eyes say death. The simplest part of this poem is the truth in each one of us to which it is speaking. How much of this truth can I bear to see and still live unblinded? How much of this pain can I use? We cannot live without our lives. We cannot live without our lives.